This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of local Black activists describing their experiences navigating activism and politics in the areas of grassroots organizing, electoral politics, academia, and advocacy. They also explore how their work impacts them personally and what they hope to achieve on the local, state, and national level. On the panel are Dr. Darius Bost, Assistant Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of Utah, Natalie Pinckney, South Salt Lake City Council member, Rosine Nibishaka, President of the East High School Black Student Union, Olivia Winston, Vice President of the East High School Black Student Union, and Lex Scott, Founder of Black Lives Matter Utah. Moderating the panel is Tisha G. Kofi, Chair of the Black Faculty and Staff Association at the U. This forum was recorded on January 22, 2020, presented as part of the University of Utah's Martin Luther King Jr. Week programming. Here's your moderator, Tisha G. Kofi.
Let's jump right in. Our first question for our panelists. What need did you identify in your prospective communities, and what motivated you to want to address that need?
Is it working?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So a need that we identified at East High School was we had a lot of groups. A lot of kids had groups that they could go to, like they had the Latino Student Union. But the Black kids at East High, we were kind of like all over the place. It was always like an idea that we had because a lot of other schools did have Black Student Unions. And then I remember we had Lex Scott. She came and spoke at our school, and she gave this powerful presentation that basically was like, okay, we need to get this club, and there's a lot of issues at East that we needed to get started on.
Yeah, and something else is there were some videos going around about people saying racial slurs and things like that. It's part of the reason why Lex came and spoke. And then there's an overall issue with like the N-word and things, and I had noticed it and I didn't know what to do. And then after Lex Scott's presentation that day, almost every Black student at East was in one room, and there were so many of us, and I didn't know that there were so many of us. So then that inspired me to want to create a Black Student Union and try to fix the problems we see. Ooh.
These women inspire me, though. I mean, they went out and they did it, and they're gung-ho, and they have this killer thing. But what inspired me was Eric Garner. I saw Eric Garner getting choked to death by police, and I had seen too many videos of police brutality and murder at the hands of police. And so I just, did it stop? I decided to do something about it, get off the couch. Stop being a keyboard warrior. Go out there and end police brutality and hold police accountable for their actions. And instead of just watching this helplessly and typing shake my head and scrolling past it on Facebook and Twitter, I said, okay, the goal is to end police brutality in my lifetime, to hold them accountable, to pass legislation that says that they can't investigate their own crimes and find themselves innocent, to pass body cam legislation, to get less than lethal weapons in police cars. And so that's what I've been doing ever since. And yeah, okay.
I decided to run for office. So in the city of South Salt Lake, we're a pretty diverse population, but all of our representatives do not reflect that. It's a working class neighborhood where, you know, a lot of things that I grew up seeing, I see in the neighbors today. So I decided to kind of put my hat in the ring and run for office to be that voice that wasn't afraid to talk about social justice, not afraid to talk about equity and about real accountability. So that's where I just decided to knock doors and talk to neighbors and really get to the heart of the issue. And it was really scary. And sometimes I questioned why I was doing it in the first place, until you talk to someone who brought up problems that they could never bring up at a city council meeting, that they would never feel comfortable coming and talking to a representative, and then going back to the city and say, you know, I can't have the same answers everyone else in this council has because I talk to different people than all of you. And that really showed me how important representation is, and for elected officials who understand what changes, what ordinances and policies need to go into place. So that's kind of, I guess, my answer.
Hello. Okay. My work, I'm an assistant professor in ethnic studies here, and my work is primarily around HIV/AIDS in Black communities, both here and abroad. And part of the reason that I started engaging in this work is because of the statistics, the dire statistics in our community. Every year, the CDC releases statistics that say 1 out of 2 Black, gay, or bisexual men will have HIV in their lifetime. 50% of Black trans women are living with HIV. And the latest statistic released about deaths is that around 4,000 African Americans have died of HIV disease in 2015. And a lot of this work is because folks think about HIV and the AIDS crisis as a thing of the past, but it's still affecting Black communities, both here and abroad, primarily in the American South, in the Global South, and in the Northeast. And so much of my work has been about highlighting this ongoing struggle in Black communities, and thinking about, which I think about has sort of broader implications for African Americans and their struggles against health inequality that have been happening since their arrival here in the West.
Thank you. Thank you all so much. Next question. What fears presented to themselves as you weighed whether to become proactive around that need?
Okay, so a couple of fears that I had about starting the club at East High School was, being a student at a high school, a lot of kids are very ignorant towards other things that are affecting people of color. So one of my biggest fears was encounters that I'm going to have, that I was going to lose certain friendships that I have made, and really what people were going to think overall of me. I didn't want to lose my friends, but a big part of me knew that this was the right thing to do. And I knew that if I wasn't going to be part of the solution, then I would become the problem, and I didn't want to be the problem.
Part of my fear, so I am adopted. I was raised by 2 white parents in a white neighborhood. All of my friends are white. We're white. And so I was I was scared I was going to lose friendships like Rosine, and that people were going to start judging me and stop accepting me in my neighborhood. And that was a really scary thing. And I had been so sheltered my whole life, so I was scared for what other racial things will come up and what people will say to me. And then I was like, if they're not going to be my friends, if they're going to start calling me racial slurs, if they're going to do this or that, then I don't want them in my life. So why would I care?
I think I entered civil rights really naively, and I think Hollywood glamorizes civil rights with all these movies where they start off with a problem, and in the end, the activists win, and it's not like that, like, ever. And I think that the mental health aspect of working in civil rights is the thing that I took light of, because this work destroys your mental health. Seeing death and police brutality videos every day and getting calls from moms who just lost their kids, it doesn't really affect your health. So I wasn't really afraid of anything because I watched all the movies. Of course I'm going to win everything I do. I didn't have fear. There are moments of fear in this movement. There are moments of will this cop pull out his gun and kill me right now, right? there are moments of, will the Ku Klux Klan bomb my house because I'm the leader of Black Lives Matter, right? Will they hurt? They threaten my kids, right? So, and I told my mentor, and I said, hey, they're threatening my family. Should I listen to them? And he said, I don't know. Ask yourself if they've ever hurt children before. And we know in Birmingham, right, what they bombed the church and killed the little girls. And he said, have you ever seen white supremacists perpetrate violence against black activists? If you have, that's your answer. So you either stay in and accept that and decide what your acceptable risks are and then go from there. But in the end, if we die for our work, they just created a martyr. They just made us more powerful. So it's like, what are you doing, buddy? If I die for my work, I lived a long life. Who cares? I'd rather live, though. And so I guess the only fear is like when I get the death threats and people follow me home at night. All right. Wow.
There's a lot of fear when you want to enter a political sphere. You know, before, you know, you can go to ACT, you go rallies, you can speak at rallies, like, and there's definitely a lot of unsafety around that. But when you decide to enter a political sphere, there is so much more on the line. People are not afraid to yell at you at a door, slam a door in your face, tell you how worthless you are and everything that you stand for. But also you jeopardize your career in a bet too. You have to really decide, okay, if I enter a political sphere and I make comments, what is my actual personal career look like? What am I setting myself up for? And I think us being in a very individualistic society, that's on purpose, right? To say, am I willing to risk what my life is like, or am I wanting to help people? Because that's really the decision you have to make if you decide to take politics very seriously and because you want to, you know, really advocate for what's right at the end of the day. So the fear I didn't really have on the campaign trail, mostly when I won, I got really fearful. I was like, oh, cool. Let's do everything I said I was going to do. So now, like, the fear is set in, right? Because now I have to stand up and I have to say what I want to say and what I think is right. And maybe I'm completely wrong. You know, it's not just me on a council, it's six other people. And they could all be like, great idea. No. And I have to just like take that as well and then keep pushing at the end of the day. So your reputation's on the line. You have no idea what the future will hold, but you just have to know at the end of the day, you're doing what you know are going to help people. And that's going to help you keep pushing forward. Yeah.
I think for me, the biggest fear around my work is that people wouldn't care because I'm writing about communities that are marginalized and then communities that are marginalized within those communities. Because of the history of race in this country, oftentimes Black Americans have not wanted to talk about issues of gender and sexuality because they've been historically marked by notions of gender and sexual deviance. So to talk about issues of HIV and AIDS in our community is to expose, right, these sort of violent histories that have been attached to Black bodies. I think also part of doing this work is meanings outing oneself, right, and talking about LGBTQ communities. That has both been an issue for me personally in my family, but also the places that I've worked. When I was director of an Institute of Black Culture at the University of Florida, I faced homophobia by Black staff, students, and faculty, and they eventually ran me out. But that inspired me to go back to graduate school to do this work around Black gender and sexuality and to continue to do the work that I do. So the concern for me is not necessarily about fearful of doing this work, but the fear that folks won't care about these communities because they're already stigmatized and often blamed for their own illnesses.
Wow. Thank you all so much. Thank you all for your honesty up to now. Wow. All right. What political challenges did you face? And what did you do to overcome these challenges?
A lot of the political challenges that we faced at East High in trying to get the club started was we did have this conversation going around of some of the white students saying that since we're going to have a black student union, that they should also have a white student union. At a certain extent, it was kind of expected, and I was very disappointed because a lot of the kids, instead of like trying to hear and actually listen to us and why we felt like this club was needed at East, they just saw it as a black versus white kind of thing, but that's not what it was. It was way more than that, and we did let them know that you can come to this club. If you're an ally, you can come and support us, and we would love to learn from you and also have you learn from us. But at that point in time, it just seemed like it was something that they weren't interested in.
Yeah, and going off of that, we did have somebody come to a meeting, and I forgot what we were talking. I think we were talking about colorism that day or something, police brutality as well. And this boy that came was one of my friends, and right after he left, he was like in tears, and he was like, I didn't know like you guys went through this. I didn't know. So I think that was a big thing too.
I think I was really naive also about politics when I came into this. And I had struggles like people in Black Lives Matter saying, hey, support this candidate because they're doing these things, and support this candidate because they're doing these things, and hey, don't upset this candidate. But anyone who knows me knows I don't care. I'm going to do whatever I want. And now the candidates come to me for an endorsement. And I remember last year, one of the mayoral candidates said, we need you to endorse this person and show up at for the party. And it was like 2 hours before the thing, the press conference. And I thought that was a little, you know, assumptive that I'm supporting you. But I showed up anyway. Now, the other day, I was just saying about the mayor, Mendenhall, who we meet with police every 2 weeks, and we've been doing this for 3 years, about police accountability and transparency. And the way we got those meetings was we protested Mayor Biskupski 30 times. And she finally gave up and said, and it wasn't just us, it was Utah Against Police Brutality as well. But she finally gave up and said, okay, let's bring the activists to the table with the police. And so we've been having these meetings. Now we have this new mayor, and I sent her an email saying, we would like these meetings to continue, and we would like a representative from the mayor's office to attend every meeting, because Biskupski sent a representative to attend every meeting. And Mendenhall didn't return my email. And I told my husband, and I said, she's going to find out really quick. The mayor doesn't run Salt Lake City. The people do. And she did. So I just marched over to City Hall. Just marched over there, and I said, hey, what's going on? You know, we're being diplomatic. You need to be diplomatic. When a group that doesn't have to show diplomacy says to you, be diplomatic with me, come to the table with me, and you ignore me, I'm going to show you what happens when people ignore me. And they agreed to send not one but two representatives to the meetings. So for me, politics, it's ugly. I hear politicians say things to me that they don't say in the media, and I see them act a certain way with me that they don't act in the media. So that's why we came out with the police accountability and transparency form. We make every candidate before they are elected fill out our form and make promises to Black Lives Matter before they're elected. So if you make these promises to me before you're elected, then I'm going to hold you to them after you're elected. So anyway, politics is really gross. I just choose the candidates that I like, and I run with them. And sometimes they work out, and sometimes they don't. And I think it's a big deal that we finally have a Black councilwoman here on South Salt Lake. Can we have a round of applause for her?
Um, I'm also involved in Black Caucus, and we were actually at a meeting the other day, and I was like, we just will call Lex and we'll tell her what we want to say and we'll just keep our titles. but no, politics, kind of piggyback off of Lex, it's very complicated. I was actually at a forum, and everyone who's running for office is, you know, white or white passing. And the conversation kind of came up about police. And everyone basically said, you know, there are no bad cops, only bad people, or, you know, things of that magnitude. And the question came to me. And in that moment, I had to decide what politician I was going to be. Am I going to say the right answer because I want a police endorsement, or am I going to speak my truth? And I decided to speak my truth. And I said, I can't tell you whether or not there are bad cops or good cops. Show me the data, and then I can respond to you. And that really, you know, made the conversation real, because I think sometimes you are entering these institutions and, you know, people might think, okay, you don't like cops or you don't like this. And it's like, that's not the conversation that we're having. The conversation is that I go to doors and people tell me that they've been profiled. And those real conversations I've had when I'm in neighborhoods, they've been profiled, or there are gunshots and there's little kids around and no one comes because this neighborhood has high crime. The police do not come to this neighborhood. So, you know, in that moment, that was really scary because I had not been elected, but I had to face my truth. And I had to say that I, again, have different experiences. And that actually opened up a better conversation. Our police department wanted to, now we're working on different trainings of, like, why did I get pulled over, and really being more transparent in our community. But if I had not took that leap because politics tells you otherwise, then what am I doing? Why am I here? I'm just creating the same thing over and over again. And at the end of the day, I'm not moving towards civil rights. I'm moving the other way.
I think one of the biggest challenges I think people face in thinking about HIV/AIDS is that public health controls the narrative, and no shade to anyone who is in public health here, but there are a lot of issues around the way that they have championed treatment and prevention on an individual kind of biomedical level, when we really know that it is already existing structural inequalities that are producing the disproportionate impact of HIV/AIDS in Black communities. And so that sort of speaks to one of the issues that I've been working on for a while. It's up until 2019, and there was a young man named Michael Johnson who was in Missouri, who had been sentenced to 30.5 years for infecting someone else with HIV, with several other people. And it was a very racialized and sexualized thing, that they used his screen name, Tiger Mandingo, from his dating app. They showed pictures of his genitals in the courtroom. And so they were really sort of conjuring this issue around sort of historic narrative around sort of Black males as being having a predatory sexuality. This issue around HIV sort of dovetails with other issues like the over-incarceration of African Americans, sort of continuing issues around HIV criminalization. What does it mean to punish people for their illness? And the sort of existing narratives, he came from a low-income background. He had he has disabilities, right? All these other issues sort of intersected with his struggles against AIDS. But none of these issues are sort of the domain of public health, because the concern is about protecting people from individual forms of transmission. And actually, in public health, one of the things that they do right now when they identify folks who are positive is call the police, right? So for me, like, the challenge, what I've been trying to do in my work is highlight what communities of color, what marginalized communities have done to protect themselves from AIDS, to educate themselves about AIDS, and to struggle and survive amid the AIDS epidemic, right? To sort of move the sort of narrative away from the domain of public health to think about what these communities have done to sustain themselves.
Yeah. I think one of the really great takeaways from that is that it kind of presented itself to me that you all not only have to face and overcome political challenges around your work, but yet being able to balance using politics to your advantage while still staying true to your authentic self. So figuring out where that balance is and what can be most effective for you. Thank you. All right.
That was Tisha G. Coffey, moderator and chair of the Black Faculty and Staff Association at the U. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing a forum on the intersection of activism and politics featuring a panel of local Black activists. Here again is moderator Tisha G. Kofi.
So looking back, how did you evolve as an activist? And what role did fear play in your evolution of self?
I'll start. So I really got involved in activism because of grad school. I got really passionate about access to education and wanted to get involved. Found myself at a Black Lives Matter meeting, and then found myself at rallies and protesting against Ben Shapiro. So it escalated very quickly. And I loved that route a lot, but you know, I also found that going back to politics, that you can protest, but if you don't have elected officials that also consider education to be a right, or should, you know, we should help poor people and they shouldn't struggle, then we're not going as far as we could possibly go. So I really evolved as a like kind of rally activist to more of a political activist because of that need that I saw, and because of my connections, and I felt like, you know, that's an advantage that I could use at the end of the day. So it's kind of a weird evolution, but I think it's also a natural progression. Like sometimes activism presents itself very differently, and this was the way that I knew that I could be probably the most successful in this movement, to help folks like Lex Scott who are doing the groundwork. You also need people on the other side who kind of know the system and know how to help those folks who are doing it.
I feel like I evolved. I was just a regular student attending, you know, East High School, to kind of like a student activist, I would say, because now I do have students at East who they have questions about cultural appropriation or about why they can and can't say the N-word or just something that they're unclear of. They do come to me and I do have those conversations with them, and I'm very honored that I've been given that platform with a club for students to be able to come and ask questions when they are confused. Yeah.
So I'm freshman year. I was still kind of just like, I'm not going to say anything if I heard anything racial, anything. I was like, oh, it's fine. They'll learn eventually. And then sophomore year, I was kind of like, maybe I should say something. I don't know. Then junior year, when Lex Scott came, I after that whole presentation and everything, we have this, I'm in student government at East, and we have this thing called the cry closet, and it's where you go if you're upset or anything. So while she was in this room talking to all of us, I went in the cry closet and I was bawling, and I was like, no, like, I need to do something about it. Like, I can't just sit in here and cry. And so that's when I think I was like, I need to say something. I need to stand up. I need to do something. And then senior year, I don't know, I feel like I'm getting better at it. I still have so much more to learn and so much more I want to do, so much more I have to do. So I think that's kind of how I evolved.
I'm trying not to cry on this panel. Hey, I saw two more activists come in from the African American Genealogical Society. Please stand up. Woo! That's the president. Okay. As an activist, you mean how did I devolve as an activist? I think we all find ourselves in life, and mm-hmm. None of us know what we're doing, because if we knew how to achieve what we are trying to achieve, Then we would have achieved it. And so we try every different thing, and there are different types of activists. There are the activists that register people to vote. There are the activists that protest. They're the activists that run for office, the activists that circulate petitions or do calling campaigns. And I think in my activism, every year I learn something new about being intersectional. And in case you don't know what that means that when you are performing activism, it must be intersectional. That means you represent, or you don't represent, but you help support the LGBTQIA community, women, people with disabilities, the Latinx community, the indigenous community, the Pacific Islander community, Asians, you name it. I know I'm forgetting somebody, I always do. And you have to make sure that your activism is intersectional, because if you're only fighting for yourself, you're doing nothing, really. And a quote that I say over and over again, if your feminism or your civil rights are not intersectional, your feminism and your civil rights are trash. And in my activism in the beginning, I tried to be proper. I tried to use proper grammar and spelling and tried to be polite and tried to not offend people. And now I cuss a lot and I do whatever I want. And I realized that I have to be Lex. And it's not about not offending people and walking on eggshells and being politically correct and practicing respectability politics. It is about changing lives and being loud about it, however you choose to be loud about it. So I'd say in my activism, I've gotten louder, more blunt, I just see the end goal in everything. You know, a lot of activists aren't goal-driven. They give a lot of speeches, right? But they don't accomplish a lot of goals. So everything I set out to do, here's the end goal. Now, how are we going to get to that? Do I always get to it? No. I failed. I failed last year at camp, getting someone famous to come speak at camp. No one would return my calls. I'm too controversial. But I just am really goal-driven. I set a goal. I decide what I'm going to do, and I do that, and I cuss a lot. Thank you.
I think, you know, one of the things I should say is that at this point, I feel like I identify or am identified more as a scholar. And I think my biggest fear is that the work that I try to do, even though it is geared towards change, will be just simply absorbed by the institution. And figuring out how to use the skill sets that I have to still support social movements. And what I can say that I have learned is to sort of think more expansively about what counts as activism. If that means that I can help support communities who are trying to archive their own histories, if it means working with a museum exhibit to help them document histories of dancers who were lost to AIDS, right? It's about figuring out what it is that you do well and trying to support those who are engaged in the work of social and cultural transformation.
All right. So Lex, Olivia, Rosine, Natalie, Dr. Boss, please tell us, what does the road ahead look like for you? And what advice do you have for individuals who are apprehensive about engaging in activism and becoming proactive around social justice and equity issues that matter?
For me, I'm a dancer, so I want to move to New York, and I don't know what. I just want to become active there. I'll find out how. Maybe I'll talk to Lex. some advice that a teacher gave to me the last year or a couple years ago, whenever, was to just know your facts. And if somebody came up to you and asked you, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Why is this important? You should know exactly what you're doing, exactly why you're doing it, and like knowing the history behind it too. So.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with passing a bill for police reform. I'm obsessed with it. And I want, and I went to Washington last year and I just waited at the bottom of the Capitol steps and I was just, all the congressmen were coming down. They're so nice. If you ever want to meet a congressman, just go to the Capitol. And I was there, and then Ben McAdam came down, and he's like, do you want a tour of the Capitol? I'm like, yes.
But really, I was there to shop my bill, my police accountability and transparency bill. And so this summer, I'm going to take a week or 2 weeks to get a commitment from a congressman or a senator to sponsor or carry my bill, because we need a national bill on police reform. And that's the end goal. I want this bill. I want someone to carry it, sponsor it, and pass it. And so just from, you know, I have the Black History Museum we're making, and we have summer camp, and we have Black Lives Matter ski camp, and we have, you know, we have all these things. But the end goal is I don't want moms like Darren Hunt's mom to exist, and Bobby Duckworth's mom, and Patrick Harmon, and Elijah Smith, and Diamante Rivore, and Sandrea Europe. I don't want moms to ever call me again and say, why didn't they charge the officer? I want officers to be held accountable for their actions. And guess what? I'm going to make this a reality. I will pass a national police reform bill. So that's the road ahead for me, and pizza and coffee.
The road ahead for me, I really do have a goal of making sure that the BSU at East High stays there for as long as it's needed. There is kind of like worry about like when Olivia leaves or when I leave, and like kind of like what's going to happen with the club. So I really do want our club members and to just grow the club and for them to just become as passionate about it and to keep it going, because it is very important. And my advice to anyone would be, growing up in Utah and being Black, I've always been told that there's certain things that I can or can't do, certain things that I should or shouldn't say. And I feel like with the club, I've really evolved with, whenever I do have something to say, I've learned to give like my voice and my opinions. I've learned to give them a voice, and that they are important, that they do matter. So to anyone out there, if you've ever been in a room in a situation and you've had something that you felt the need to say and it was important to you, I highly do encourage that you do find the courage to say what you need to say. And because I'm pretty sure someone out there needs to hear it.
The road ahead. So I really want to work with our city to kind of expand our definition of public safety. My goal is to really address the root causes of why, you know, crime happens. You know, I don't think people don't just, well, some people might still because they're bored, but majority of people don't do that. So I really want to work to help out folks who are struggling paycheck to paycheck, to really identify underemployment. I think unemployment is really a big conversation, but our city faces a lot of underemployment and people who are working multiple jobs and still aren't able to meet their goals and meet their bills. So that's kind of what the road ahead looks for me. Continue to be a voice and say things that probably haven't been said before. My advice for anyone who is thinking about, you know, politics, whatever that may be, is just go for it. It is kind of scary, but it's also not at the same time once you enter it. There are a lot of people who have the same voice that you do or the same ideas, and it's just finding those folks and creating a coalition of people to support each other. I don't do this by myself, and I no way could do this by myself. So I would say don't be afraid. Don't let that fear hold you back, because you don't know what your potential is until you try it.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to this question. I think, you know, the one thing I can say in terms of studying African-American history and culture is that the road to liberation is very long. And for me, it's about thinking about what do we need to sustain us in these movements, but also thinking about what does it look like to envision an alternative future. Much of the discourse right now is about sort of managing a chronic illness when it's speaking to AIDS, but which has meant that since most of the people who are affected by AIDS are marginalized, there's really not a big conversation about finding a cure. So for me, it's about continuing to be critical of the administration, continuing to be critical of public health and their alternative interests, right, until the HIV epidemic is ended.
That was Dr. Darius Bost, Assistant Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience of faculty and students. Once more, here is moderator and chair of the Black Faculty and Staff Association at the U, Tisha G. Kofi.
All right, we will now be taking questions from the audience. So we'll be taking questions from students first. So if you are a student and you'd like to ask a question, raise your hand and we'll bring you the microphone.
My question is for you. What is your bill on police brutality?
Yeah, please.
Because they're recording it, right? It's called the Police Accountability and Transparency Act. I've never written a bill. I literally looked up bills that had passed. So I Googled civil rights bills that had passed. Ah.
Right.
Then I Googled format for writing a bill. And then basically I put all the things. I made it an act because the Civil Rights Act is multifaceted. So you can put multiple things. And you know what? I haven't read it in so long. It's on my fridge and like it's in our office space. But pretty much, I mean, the most important thing in police accountability is to get civilian independent review boards that have the power to investigate police. Because when a police officer is killed, or when a human is killed by a police officer, what happens is if someone is killed in Salt Lake by a Salt Lake officer, then West Valley City comes in and investigates Salt Lake PD, right? And then 2 months later, when West Valley PD kills someone, Salt Lake PD comes to investigate. It's a conflict of interest. So I would like money for civilian review boards, right? Independent civilian review boards. They say you can't be a former police officer. You can't have a family member who's a police officer. Body cam footage. For example, in Utah, we have body cams, right? Ferguson, Missouri, they don't even have dash cams. Dash cams, right? So until we regulate, until we say, hey, every police department should have body cams, even dash cams, come on, guys. De-escalation training is my bill. Diversity training is in my bill. Increasing the diversity of every police department is in my bill. And then increasing less than lethal weapons. So in Salt Lake City, because of our work, and I will take credit, and I will give the credit to Black Lives Matter for this. With our work with police, Salt Lake Police did remove 70 lethal shotguns from their cars in 2019 and replace those with less than lethal weapons, right? I want more lethal weapons off the streets and less than lethal weapons. So I don't know. I should read the bill again. It's really long.
Thank you.
So in the BSU here at the university, I've heard a lot of students say that they get tired. They get tired of correcting people, of educating people, of even thinking about the little microaggressions that they face every day. And I just want to know how you guys sustain the motivation to continue to do what you do when it is tiring work.
Yeah.
I feel like for me personally, it does kind of like get exhausting. Like it was at a certain point because just anybody who came like at me or at the club, it was like I automatically wanted to respond. And I did have a kid who was like very good at that. But I feel like I really had to learn how to pick my battles. And sometimes there's people who are going to come just because like they want to get on your nerves or they want to annoy you. And then there's people who are coming because they want to learn. And I would rather invest my time into that person than the person with all of the negativity.
Can I kind of piggyback off your question a little bit? Anytime anybody brings up questions like yours, like how do you sustain your stuff, always having to sit out here and educate people, especially in the realm of a faculty and you know employment, is that the question that I always ask when I'm asked that question is, where do we get to the point of stop educating people and hold people accountable? whereas 2020, there was an incident of a white student rubbing their hands through another African-American student's hair because they was fascinated by the texture. And the argument was, well, we got to educate them about African hair. I said, in 2020, no, we don't. No, we don't. And so it's always a challenge between, okay, where do we stop the education and expect people to start educating themselves and hold them accountable about whether they have done the work that we've put in? It's always an interesting question when it comes to questions like that. So, yeah.
So the discussion briefly touched on this. You talked about the different methods and strategies of social justice activism. My question is, how do you deal with like criticisms that you get from people within your own movement saying that you're being too loud, too aggressive, or too calm, too behind the scenes? And similarly, off of that, when people criticize like identity performance, I know within LGBTQIA activism, there's a lot of, you know, someone's being too gay or not gay enough. How do you deal with those critiques from people within your interests?
That's a great question. I think that's something that, you know, I struggled with a little bit growing up and finding my identity in college and grad school was like, you know, oh, like you speak white for a black girl. And really being like, okay, well, you know, I don't know if I'm really a good representation of what I'm working on. And then having to realize that like there are 40 million black people, so there's 40 million different experiences that people have. And there are some things that do are common for all of us, and there are some things that are not common for all of us at all. So in those spaces, like especially when I was running for office, like sometimes you're forced to be the black political candidate. Even if you don't want to be, it doesn't matter. Like you're in Utah. Congratulations, you are. So I think in that experience was like being authentic to myself. That's why I was really, you know, transparent about sharing my story and then like leading with that, right? Like if I'm gonna lead based on what I know, not on based on what I don't know. Like I'm not gonna perform, I'm not gonna do slang, I'm not like it will sound bad, like I know it, you know? And I think people appreciate that, right? And I think sometimes there are people even within your own community that are not for you, that won't support you. And that's unfortunate, but that doesn't mean what you're doing is like wrong at the end of the day. I think that you have to really go with your gut, and that's probably a really hard thing when you're taking on activism, is that you tend to stop listening to your gut, and then you start doing things that are contrary to your own values, and then you have to remind yourself why you're doing it in the first place. So that's just one thing that I have to remind myself, is that what does my gut say? And then the minute I'm doing something that is contrary to my values, that means that I'm no longer being an activist, and I need to remove myself from the situation.
Sorry, I saw this hand first.
Wait, can I just say one thing about Martin Luther King?
Yes.
Because that's why we're here, right?
Yes.
I thought so. People hated Martin Luther King. They hated him. They said he was too radical. They said that he stirred up the black people and that he hated white people. And I went to the Schomburg Museum in New York City last year and I read the letters. He used to get hate mail, right? And so when I think about people bashing me, because people bash me every day, every day I make a friend, I make 10 enemies. And I think about how much they bashed Martin Luther King and how much they whitewash his memory and say, oh, he's peaceful and he wanted all these things. No, Martin Luther King was arrested 30 times fighting for black rights and fighting against police brutality and racism. And they sanitized his image. And then I think about Muhammad Ali and when he lost his boxing license, right, because he stood up and said he didn't want to fight in the Vietnam War, and people bashed him. And then I think of Malcolm X, how he was kicked out of the Nation of Islam, and the Nation of Islam bashed him. And so, yeah, we're going to get bashed, but was it Malcolm or Martin that said, if you don't have critics, that you're doing something wrong or something? So, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to that question quickly, and just to say two things. One, that, you know, since this is about MLK, to think about mm-hmm. how most movements are multi-pronged, that they're happening at multiple levels. from the grassroots up to people working in the higher echelons of government. But also, the sort of question around identity-based movements and concerns, like, reminds us about how our movements have to be broad-based, right? Meaning, just come back to the earlier response, that not just thinking about intersectionality in terms of thinking of people inhabiting multiple identities and having multiple needs, but also thinking about how these issues that we're talking about are always interconnected with other issues. And so part of the way to address that is to have a sort of broad-based concern that thinks about, right, for me, right, even if I'm thinking about sort of Black trans women, right, I have to think about HIV and AIDS. I have to think about incarceration, right? I have to think about gun violence as an issue, since so many of them are murdered, right? How are we reconceiving our movement so that they are sort of encompassing the sort of multiple fronts upon which people are sort of fighting?
For the Black Student Union at East High School, I would like to know, what are you doing towards the inclusion of ESL and former undocumented students at East High School?
You want to know what we're doing towards, like, including the ESL students? So at East High, we are very diverse, even our BSU, if you do look into it. We do have people coming from different parts of Africa. And the cool thing about it, the new kids who just came here, like, as refugees, and they are part of, like, the ESL, we do have students in BSU who have been there for a while and do speak some of their languages. So that does really benefit us in being able to communicate with them and being able to get them to our activities.
We have time for one more question.
Over here. Hi, this is for anyone. But basically, I feel like I've had a couple times where I've, like, tried to, like, start movements or, like, be involved in a movement, and I have a really hard time getting people to show up. Like, I have a lot of people that are, like, so passionate about it, and I'll ask them, be like, oh, yeah, come be involved, like, come join this with me. And then, like, when it comes to, like, the last minute, like, we have, like, the date set, and then nobody, like, shows up. Do you know what I mean? So it's, like, how do you actually get people to come places? Yep. Well, we're still working on that. I don't know. Yeah. Wow. For the
food.
I mean, boys, they're just... We've expected they're not going to show up. But yeah, they came to Harriet. If there's food, like, I found, like, if there's food or if there's, like, we went to see Harriet, if there's an incentive, people show up, other than, like, just, I don't. We're, like, still struggling.
I don't know. I feel like also a big part of it is, like, with BSU, like, when it did start, it was, like, a lot of, like, checking up on people who we knew they were interested, but, like you said, like, when the day of the event comes, like, nobody shows up, so, like, constantly, like, hey, I'll go with you, like, do you need a ride? Just constantly, like, checking up on them or, like, getting them to arrive there with you. It's kind of tricky. It's kind of hard.
Yeah. People are full of it.
I second that.
I learned that if I want a successful event, then I need to plan it 2 weeks out for activists and expect them to show an hour late. So plan it an hour early, and then they will be on time, because activists are a hot mess. Then you have to not only plan it, so if I want a successful protest, right, the Ben Shapiro protest on your campus, I planned that a month in advance. Right? I created an event on Facebook, the old people network, and then tweeted it out, and then I posted in the event all the time, emailed people. You have to remind people. I think people, there's someone in Black Lives Matter who plans events the day before, and then he's like, no one came. And I'm like, for real, man? Like, no one's gonna come. And also, I just want to say this. I've learned to focus on quality and not quantity, okay? There are very few activists who are gonna last in activism for more than 1 year. And that's just a fact because of the burnout and the trauma, and they didn't, and people want change really fast. Well, Black people have been fighting for their rights since we stepped off the boat. You want it to end in 3 months. You know, you don't see change in 3 months. You're, oh, well, nothing ever changes. Bro, okay, so so what we need is patience, and what you need to find are the activists who are worth their salt. And they are rare because any Black, Utah's 2% Black, and I'll tell you what, any Black person worth their salt here already is a councilwoman, already is a professor, already runs their own BSU, right? Runs the African American Genealogical and Historical Foundation, right? And those people already are running their own organizations, right? So you gotta stop hoping for big crowds and start hoping for good crowds to come.
Thank you.
That's a wrap up. Thank you all for coming. And if you could please join me in thanking our guests for a very interesting, empowering forum.
If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.